This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is painter and sculptor Red Grooms. Much of Grooms' art burlesques the pandemonium of city life, like his now-famous piece Ruckus Manhattan. Ruckus Manhattan is one of his 3D walkthrough environments, which he calls sculpto-pictoramas. Red Grooms transforms the gallery into a miniature city in a style inspired by cartoons, comic books, advertising, and movies. Ruckus Manhattan has its own crowded subway car, a taxi complete with a fast-talking cabbie, and a 17-foot-high Woolworth building that has wrapped around it a dragon with movable wings, reminiscent of 1950s monster movies. The streets are teeming with Grooms' caricatures of businessmen, shoppers, bag people, pimps, whores, and policemen. Grooms has taken on other cities like Chicago and Philadelphia, but he didn't really live in a city until he was an adult. He grew up in a suburb of Nashville. After dropping out of art school, he decided to make Manhattan his home. Grooms once described himself as wanting to be a contrast to the heavy aesthetic side of art. That stance and the difficulty of fitting him into anyone's style of art may have kept him out of the museum world for many years. In 1985, when he was 48, Grooms was given his first major museum retrospective at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts in Philadelphia. The show has since traveled to several other major museums. It's brought together his pieces about cities with his homages to art history, portraits of friends and family, and a movie theater he designed to screen the short films he's been making since the 1960s. I asked Red Grooms if he ever thinks of his cityscapes like Ruckus Manhattan as comedies about the danger and paranoia of city living.
When I was in London recently, English person said that New Yorkers have this fantasy of themselves living in a rough, tough place, always endangered by some threatening evil. And maybe I actually indulged in that, I think, with some of my city pieces. I actually saw the danger and the violence as almost a kind of badge of glamour and so forth for city livers.
The city is the subject of a good deal of your work, though hardly all of it. Do you see your sculptures and sculptor pictoramas and paintings of the city as being a kind of modern equivalent of landscape painting?
Well, I think I got interested in the crowd, sort of the masses of people as a sort of colorful means to escape the suburbs, really. I was living in the suburbs of Nashville, and I would go uptown sort of usually by myself and go to see films on a Saturday. I'd like to see sometimes a couple films on a Saturday afternoon, but I also enjoyed looking at the people. And I always kind of wished Nashville was a bigger city than it actually was at that time. And I think that desire to really submerge myself in the crowd gave me the desire to move to New York, because finally I really would be in a huge metropolis.
What attracted you to it? Was it the energy, the colors?
I think it was less of an attraction to it than more of a desire to get out of the boredom of the suburbs. I think that I think I was bored to death in the suburbs. Not so much with my family. I enjoyed my home life. I had a very nice family life, and I enjoyed that, but I think finally, I grew up in got out of high school in 55, so I'd sort of been through the really heavy Eisenhower years and the really when the so-called square was for real, and I just found it hard to kind of find a place in that atmosphere. There was no place to kind of get comfortable, and I sort of perceived big city life as kind of a place where you could meet something a little richer.
Well, I think some of the first times that you actually lived in the city was when you went to art school, because you went, I know, to the Art Institute of Chicago, and then you went to the New School for Social Research in New York, where you studied with Hans Hoffman. But you dropped out of both schools. Did living in the city appeal to you more than actually going to school?
Yeah, I didn't. I certainly didn't want to have any more scholastic knowledge after I got out of high school. I really wanted to sort of become an artist of some sort and sort of do what I wanted to do. And I did try some odd jobs, and I made so little money. I was only making $1 an hour no matter what I tried to do. And that was kind of good, because I figured I may as well become an artist, because even if I made nothing, it wouldn't be much different than making $45 a week. So I said I took the plunge right away and went for, just went kind of all out for an art career.
Which meant what? I mean, what did you do to start it?
Well, what I really did in New York was turned out to be a pretty good strategy is I opened up my own art gallery. I opened up a gallery called City Gallery on 24th and 6th Avenue, and my friend and advisor was Jay Milder. He was about the same age as me from Omaha, Nebraska. And Jay was one of these fellas that he just was terrific. He had city smarts. He just fit in right away. And I sort of hung on to his coattails and made acquaintances. And things got smoother, you know, from the contact with friends. And having the gallery, we were able to make our work visible. And we had a certain theatrical aspect about our presentations that made people interested.
You also show the work of some now famous artists, right, like Klaus Oldenburg and Jim Dine.
I know. I wish I'd bought some of them or something. I kept one around. I remember once I had this crummy bedroom. Absolutely, it was a hole in the wall. And I literally had about 60 Jim Dine gouaches around the wall that he had just given me to put on exhibition. And I didn't keep one of them. And I also didn't sell one of them.
Huh. It seems that right from the start, more or less, when you became like an adult artist, that your work was off the canvas, that you took your work off the canvas and didn't want it confined to that. Can you talk about that kind of desire to not have your art just confined to the wall?
Right. Well, there was probably a lot of reasons for it. I was influenced by Rauschenberg, for instance. I mean, I liked his those combine works were very exciting to me, and I could see there was sort of, you know, he had already taken them by as far as you could go, and I think that it was kind of partially struggling to do flat paintings with, I was using a lot of enamel, and I was using tinning colors. I was using the cheapest paints you could get, and I would get these tinning colors, which were horrible colors. Most all my paintings are either black and white, sort of a gray color, really. Or sometimes they were sort of a reddish color, like a reddish brown color. And I would be slopping around with these paints. And one of my credos was to finish the painting in sort of one inspirational burst. I mean, I would sometimes work 3-4 hours slopping around and really get into a mess. I mean, I'd be knee-deep in slippery paint tubes, and I'd be covered with paint and sort of desperate, but still wishing I could get an image, get something out of my work. You know, it's a strange piece of work to be standing there getting nowhere after you've been working hard for 4 or 5 hours. So out of desperation, I would take something like a piece of cardboard, or even at one point I took my own shirt and stuck it onto the wet canvas. And so at least I had a dry spot to kind of come to grips with and stop slipping around. So it was kind of out of half practical experience slugging away, and half out of the times, you know, the influence of other artists, and also the work I did, the theatrical work, the happenings. I found out that there was a lot of excitement in going quite aggressive and going toward the audience, sort of literally charging toward the audience.
Did you realize that you had that theatrical bent in you before you started doing the happenings?
Oh, yeah. I always felt quite theatrical and was interested in theatrics from, well, as soon as I saw Pinocchio or something when I was a little kid.
Pinocchio did it, huh?
Yeah, I think so.
I think at one of your happenings you also painted in front of the audience.
Well, I wanted to sort of be a performer, really, and I didn't have much talent as a singer or a dancer, so I had... The only thing I could do was paint, so I figured maybe it's a good act. And I was encouraged in this madness by Dominic Falcone and Yvonne Anderson, who put on the performance in their gallery, the Sun Gallery in Provincetown.
Do you think it was a good act?
I don't know. People are still talking about it, so it must have been pretty good.
What about the painting? Were you satisfied with that?
Yeah, I like it. It looks pretty good. I mean, people can now judge for themselves, but considering it was done in 45 minutes, it's not bad.
What did fine arts appeal to you? And I ask this because, I mean, obviously you were very interested in theater and performance, although, as you said, you know, you weren't really a singer or a dancer. But a lot of your imagery is very pop in, you know, in a lot of ways. And it's ironic and it's funny and it's entertaining in a way that we've come to frequently not expect from the world of fine arts. Did you ever consider going into another form of like the popular arts instead of the fine arts?
Yeah, I was very interested in movie making. As I said, it was sort of the first culture I got in Nashville, and I was watching movies from, I don't know, 8 on. And I was very interested in the inside jobs, like being the director or being the art director, that kind of that aspect of it. And I read a lot about filmmaking. But for some reason, I'm not quite sure why. Maybe I'm underneath it all a little bit introverted, like artists kind of are. And in a way, I maybe, you know, it sort of appealed to me that sort of the fatalisticness of being an artist. Instead of doing something useful, you just do something that's sort of philosophical, really. I mean, it's sort of, you know, you can get from it whatever you want, but it's not necessarily saleable or useful or whatever.
What were the movies that made a really big impression on you when you were young?
Ah, that's a good question. Well, I like the Stanley Kramer movies. Stanley Kramer was a guy who made these kind of tough black and white films. He made a film called The Sniper that was... I like that film very much because there was a spectacular shot of the sniper on a chimney that was shot from about half a mile away. So you get this terrific jump in scale with this tiny figure, big chimney, and a lot of rough-looking sky, dark sky behind him. Things like that. I like that. I like those tough black and white pictures, kind of almost B movies. Then I like all kind of action pictures. I particularly like. Well, this may be the real reason I do like crowds and kind of big scale work is because my main criteria, what made a movie good, was how big it was. I wanted to see lots of extras, lots of action. That's what I look for.
War movies, biblical epics, things like that.
Exactly. Like? Yeah.
And you think you're doing the urban equivalent of that with casts of thousands?
Yeah, I think so. Well, yeah, I thought it was a good idea to take the city and instead of making it some great moment of history or something, just present it as a great moment of history, even though it's commonplace.
You worked as an usher for a while at the Roxy Theater in New York, which was demolished quite a while ago, as I recall, but if it's the theater I'm thinking of, it was a huge theater with a great mezzanine and a balcony. And
yeah.
Did you have to wear a uniform?
Oh, I sure did. I had a spiffy gray uniform, and I became a supervisor, so I got to wear a silver braid instead of a black braid. I was quite proud of that.
That's one of the things I used to really love about movie going is that there were all these like ceremonial aspects to it. The ushers
yeah,
had uniforms.
Right.
The theater was really enormous. There were great decorations inside.
We were generation of ushers were kind of the last of a line of ushers that was started by this guy Roxy Rothafel, who started the Roxy, and he must have been some kind of ex-Marine or something because he actually had these guys do precision drilling, and he was an absolute fanatic. I mean, we were a bunch of bums compared to those days. You know, we were like 35 years too late. But I was in the last generation of ushers at the Roxy. I was fired, in fact, because a picture called The Windjammer was brought in there, and that was one of these cinoramic pictures, and they had to get union ushers in there, and that's because it was reserved seating. And so all the guys like myself were out of the job.
In addition to your movies and your work about movies, you've done several pieces that are homages to art history, to great paintings, or to great painters. Why is art history an interesting subject for you, as the subject of your work?
Well, I guess I finally, when you get down to it, I like artists and I admire artists, and I guess I'm fascinated by artists, you know. And I don't know. I find it an appropriate subject because I've just been sort of so interested in it for so long.
Some people think that the most tired thing in the world is art about other art because it's so self-absorbed. And I wonder how you react to that.
Yeah, I could see that could be true. Well, I try to see it. When I say I like artists, I don't feel like an artist myself. I don't feel sort of too incestuous about that. I think I sort of remove myself from the profession at that time and try to see it, you know, as an outside person would. And so I don't feel too overbound into the thing about that, because I think artists, you know, they do get out into public life, and people imagine about them as they would politicians or actors or scientists.
Well, you actually are living in Chinatown in Manhattan now, right?
Right.
Is Chinatown becoming populated by a lot of artists looking for cheap loft space?
What? I think it's totally populated by Chinese. But there may be some artists. Yeah, there's a few artists around. But not in Chinatown itself. I think it's just too many Chinese to make any room for artists.
So you're one of the few artists there.
I'm there because I got the place in 1969, and Chinatown really has moved around the building I'm in. It's really sort of swept past us. Before, it was the immediate neighborhood was basically a machinist neighborhood, and has since become garment manufacturing and noodles. And I don't know what else. Videotapes, Chinese videotapes. We have a lot of that around.
So you've never been plagued by the upscale nature of the areas that artists live in, like artists move into a neighborhood
So far, my neighborhood hasn't changed for the worse. No, it's already at the worst. Sometimes I think I have to be in the running for the ugliest street in the world. And that has not changed, so I have to bear the burden of total brutality all the time, every time I step down on the street. But on the other hand, you know, it hasn't been gentrified.
Well, how ugly is it?
Bad, bad, really bad.
Can you describe it?
Oh, God.
I want to know how ugly it really is.
It's the smell as well as I won't even go into the description of the smell, but... Well, sure, sometimes it looks even beautiful, but I think about New York, there's a certain rawness. I was just in Philadelphia for a week and went back to New York for a day, and I already felt like a tourist because the place is just so beat up. It's so sort of mauled or something, and the textures are so germy and overused, and everybody seems, it's like some kind of mad stock car race or something where everybody's trying to go as fast as they can. The only way to protect yourself there is just to go as fast as you can and be aggressive. It's the safest route.
New Yorkers, I think, rationalize New York. It's a profession. I mean, everyone learns how to do it, because New Yorkers think that New York is the craziest place in the world, but they know they live in it, so they find all kinds of wonderful things about it. You obviously like love it and hate it,
so many New Yorkers do. Yeah, yeah, that's true. And once you've sort of made the effort to adapt, it's kind of hard to live in a nice place because you're sort of suspicious of it. You think, this can't be real living, you know. This is sissy. This can't be.
In your sculpto-pictoramas and paintings of the city, there are a lot of different ethnic people in it. And I wonder if some people ever think that your depictions are slightly racist, because in caricaturing the people, you kind of play up certain characteristics that in some people's hands would look kind of racist. So I wonder if that's something that you think about, and if it's something that you've gotten reactions
well,
about?
Well, I thought about it recently because I had a lot of trouble out in Denver with a piece called The Shootout, which was a big outdoor sculpture that the Indians found very offensive because it depicts a cowboy and an Indian shooting at each other. And there was a big outcry and a lot of things said back and forth. I found it very hard to defend because I was rather embarrassed by the fact that I had offended the Indian so much. To some extent, certainly not willfully, but also somewhat naively. And that did make me, yes, that made me start thinking about caricature and how it can be an unpleasant tool, really, if you're on the wrong side of it. But I think I was getting worried. I was, because first of all, I don't think you can't think about it too consciously. You have to be a good sort of, but go ahead without thinking, I think. Because if it's going to be good, and I was a little afraid that I was going to be terribly messed up, but right away I got back at it. You know, it just sort of came out. Maybe I learned. You know, I'm hoping to learn too, through doing this, and also get a better sense of people. But I think that satire and caricature are good, and I think they should be inclusive. I think everybody should be satired and be included in that kind of response.
You said that everyone should be caricatured and it should be okay. Now, you've done a lot of self-portraits.
Right.
And I wouldn't call them exactly caricatures, but you sure do look different in each one. Do you see yourself as differently from day to day as your self-portraits would reflect?
Well, I was looking at them today. It seems like it's my hairdo that changes a lot, which is true. That does happen. Weight changes and I guess your state of tiredness and fatigue also is another aspect of how you look when you see yourself. I try to go right straight at myself, too. You know, I try to be impartial when I go at it.
You look very depressed, I think, in some of them.
Some of them, yeah. Some of them. A few of them are very quite personal. You know, I tried to, you know, just sort of had my back against the wall and I just, you know, used myself as sort of a sounding board.
Do you have to look in the mirror a lot when you're doing a self-portrait?
Yeah, I think almost all those are real mirror self-portraits. I think they all are.
How can you stand looking in the mirror for so long? I don't mean like with a face like yours. How can you? But well, I mean, it's so hard for most of us to look at ourselves for really long stretches of time like that. You just start to see more than you care
you know,
to, I think.
In some sense, I like realism, really. I actually do like realism. And I think one of the stances of a realist is that you are trying to be impartial, that you're really just sort of an eye and you're just trying to see things through, you know, form and light the way they are.
Well, how impartial can you be with yourself, though?
Well, that's it. I don't know. But, I mean, I was trying to be impartial.
You now have the opportunity to stand in a museum that's surrounded with your life's output from 1956 to 1984. What are some of the things that go through your mind seeing your life work in front of you?
I think mostly at art shows you get into a social mood and just talk to people, you know. I guess to be more specific, though, about how I feel about the art, I think I'm enjoying seeing some pictures and sort of mulling over and thinking about them. They all seem familiar. I mean, 29 years isn't very long, really.
Do you have a desire now to change things in earlier works?
Oh, I used to be terribly embarrassed about early works, but I'm also a bit of a collector, so at this stage I'm sort of the collector in me has overcome the art critic, so that early works, which I signed Charles Grooms and sometimes Chaz, C-H-A-S period, are to me highly collectible.
I guess that distances you enough from worrying about how they look, because I know a lot of people don't like to see.
Oh, yeah, I was terribly embarrassed for a while, you know. You feel like you should somehow be much better than that and all that.
Do you have very, very early work from before 56? When you were a teenager or a child?
Yeah.
Do you see artistic promise in it when you look back at it?
Not really. I'm amazed I was encouraged at all. That's the strange thing. Why anybody would encourage it instead of a no-talent kid in the first place, I don't know.
Did you think of yourself as being no talent?
Well, I think, yeah, in a way, because I think the reason I did become an artist was I was kind of a sort of a bum at doing almost everything, so that the good thing about being an artist is kind of like soft information, you know, you can do a lot of fudging. So that was just perfect for me.
Did you ever do a piece on your own street, which just a couple of minutes ago you described as being the ugliest block in the world?
Oh, yeah, this alley that's being shown in Europe is just two doors down.
Oh.
And I had lived there, you know, looking at it for some 15-odd years before I finally did it.
So how did you transform it for the piece?
It wasn't hard. I mean, I just sort of, like, followed my instincts and looked at it a lot.
Can you describe it?
Yeah, it's very much kind of like a Dr. Calgary set. The alley sort of looms over you and gives this little crack of a sort of grubby-looking sky over your head. And then it has these pipes sticking out all over the place with steam coming out. And these grubby bums warming their hands over a barrel with fire coming out. And lots of trucks and loading docks and people silhouetted in these grungy-looking windows and sweatshops and...
God, that sounds great.
That's about it. You know, a lot of texture.
I'd love to see a piece like that on your block. I think that would be really bizarre. Have you ever thought about doing that?
No, I actually like to show things in contrast to the actual setting. In other words, I'd rather do Versailles and put it on my block or something like that and put the alley in Versailles. Not that that would work so well, but some sort of an idea of contrast.
Are you getting that fabulous odor from all the decaying food and garbage on your street into the alley piece?
This piece is made out of foam rubber, and by now, after it's been sitting around in crates for 3 or 4 months, it probably is beginning to create its own odor.
That was artist Red Grooms, my guest on this edition of Fresh Air. The catalog of the Red Grooms Museum Retrospective is now available in book form, published by Abrams. It's called Red Grooms, a Retrospective, and it was compiled by Judy Stein, who curated the museum show. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineers for this edition were Joyce Lieberman and Mark Moss. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Sallet is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview or for a listing of other Fresh Air programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4892. The number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible with the financial support of listeners to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.